Hi, I'm Julian Fleischer. You are about to listen to the podcast version of the Naked American Songbook. Now, due to copyright law, we can't provide all the music for on-demand listening. It sucks. We're bummed about it, too, and we're working on it. But for the moment, you can still hear my conversation and get a little taste of the music that he loves. So unbuckle up, because here we go.
Imagination. It's the third eye, the fourth estate, the fifth element, the sixth sense, the seventh seal, the eighth wonder, and the nth degree. Imagination is the power to create something out of nothing and to see into the future. Why we don't have a secretary of the imagination, I'll never know. But until then, we have artists, writers, musicians, poets, scientists, actors. These are the keepers of the imaginary flame that continues to light our way through the dark. Without imagination, Leonardo would never have painted Mona Lisa. Neil Armstrong would never have walked upon the moon. Toni Morrison would never have given us jazz. And speaking of which, Ellington would never have composed In a Sentimental Mood. As the great lyricist Johnny Burke once said, imagination is funny, makes a bee think of honey.
Just as I think of you.
And it also made a skinny young Scotsman imagine himself taking the world by storm as an actor, a writer, a singer, an entrepreneur, and eventually a global force of nature who managed to reinvent not only the iconic role of the master of ceremonies in cabaret, but the very idea of what it means to be an artist in this modern world. My guest today on the Naked American Songbook is none other than Alan Cumming. Equal parts angel and satyr, friend and foe, a giver and taker, a spiller and soaker, he's a latter-day Willy Wonka, the eccentric mythic man-child who built himself a whole world of pure imagination because the real one just wasn't cool enough. And like Wonka, Cumming both invites you to the sybaritic party but insist that you imagine yourself in your neighbor's shoes, wishing you both ecstasy and intimacy at the same time, all with a smile that's both darling and devilish. And our first track on today's show features our guest imagining himself in the role of Joanne from Stephen Sondheim's Company, singing the caustic anthem of disaffection made famous by Elaine Stritch, The Ladies Who Lunch. Worth noting is that Cumming here is singing live in front of the audience at the Cafe Carlyle here in New York City, so he doesn't even have to imagine what those ladies must look like. Everybody rise.
I'd like to propose a toast.
I'm Julian Fleischer, and this is the Naked American Songbook.
Here's to the ladies who lunch. Everybody laugh. Lounging in their caftans and planning a brunch on their own behalf. Off to the gym, then to a fitting, claiming their fat and looking grim, 'cause they've been sitting choosing a hat. Does anyone still wear a hat? I'll drink to that. So here's to the girls who stay smart. Aren't they a rushing to their classes in optical art, wishing it would pass. Another long, exhausting day, another $1,000, a matinee, a pinter play, perhaps a piece of Mahler's. I'll drink to that, and one for Mahler. I mean, why not? Here's to the girls who play wife. Aren't they too much? Keeping house but clutching a copy of Life just to keep in touch.
ones who follow the rules and meet themselves at the schools, too busy to know that they're fools. Aren't they a gem? I'll drink to them. Let's all drink to them. Here's to the girls who just watch, aren't they the best? When they get depressed, it's a bottle of scotch plus a little jest. Another chance to disapprove, another brilliant singer, another reason not to move, another vodka stinger. Here's to the girls on the go, everybody tries. Look into their eyes and you'll see what they know. Everybody dies. A toast to that invincible bunch, the dinosaurs surviving the crunch. Let's hear it for the ladies who lunch. Everybody rise, rise.
Can I not stand up after listening to that? That was my guest, the luminous Mr. Alan Cumming.
Hi.
On his recent record release,
yes.
Sappy Songs.
Alan Cumming sings Sappy Songs live at the Café Carlyle, to be the full title.
Please, please, let's be correct about it.
And this song is one in particular, because I thought I knew what The Ladies to Lunch was about, and I think most people do, but actually it's not at all how you think it is. It's dark, dark, bleak, and about everybody, you know, about all, it's almost like he's taking a swipe at all different sections of society, of life.
Well, I think
all different types of people.
I couldn't agree with you more, number one, and I think that's one of the hallmarks of a truly great song is that it continues to open itself up.
Totally.
You can continue to unpack it based on who's singing it or why they're singing it, but it's the last moments of that song that reveal just how bleak it is, because he's no longer just indicting the ladies. He's indicting everyone around them.
Yeah.
And so he's saying, well, he in this case, rise, 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 because we're all, you know, part of this.
And everybody tries. You know, that's the line that gets me.
Yeah.
That when I do it, it's like we're all trying. We're all going to find. Ooh, sorry. We're all going to die.
Fucking die.
Alone. I love that sort of absolute bleakness of it. And it's so interesting. I just love how, you know, layered it is, that song. And I just love singing it now. And also, whilst I finish my concert with it, the Alan Cumming Sings Sappy Songs one, and I pretend that I've gone already and had a cocktail. When I come back on, I do this fake, you know, encore thing. And I come back on with a martini, and it's a real martini. So I slug a martini as I'm singing that song.
Oh,
and
nice.
So it's actually got a great, the experience of singing it is so intense for me, because I go into this really intense place. And also I'm like getting wasted, because I really knock back a large amount of just pure liquor in the course of like 4 minutes.
I'm starting to drool just listening to you.
And sometimes I play it, like, you know, if you go to certain theatres, there was a place, Tampa or somewhere in Florida, and it's a university or some on the grounds of a university, and they say, oh, so it's a dry campus, we can't have a martini. I'm like, what? And then they made a special dispensation.
Oh, they
smuggled
did?
In. Yeah, guys, like, really? It's, you know, it's very important to the whole.
So it's like, it's a rider in your contract?
It's, uh-huh.
Good.
It is. Like, it's got, like, you know, mic, mm-hmm. two monitors for Alan, you know, vocal mm-hmm. mic here, the piano, the cello, and a glass of vodka martini under the table for the encore.
There you go. Next time, do gin. See where it goes.
Oh, I can't bear gin.
That's amazing. Not every gentleman in the world could get away with singing that tune.
At the Café Carlyle as well.
Yeah.
You know, Balls of Steel.
You got him. I mean, yeah. I think that's what you're known for. You are an actor, a singer,
mm-hmm.
an activist,
mm-hmm.
a writer.
Yes.
a parfumery? Parfumer? What's the word?
Parfumier?
Parfumier?
I guess. No, I'm sort of a celebrity endorser of a parfum.
Okay, but it's got your name
on it. It's got my name on it. I did sniff all the bits, yeah.
As one is wont to do.
People are always going to try and change you and make you conform. And you are the most interesting thing about yourself.
I think it's fun to know what's important. Who loves you, what you love, who you love.
I'm not going to change for anyone. Because at the end of the day, it's your essence that matters. I'm coming.
Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Julian. It's lovely to
be here. The Naked American Songbook.
Eventually. Finally.
Well, yeah, and the point here is to get naked. It's radio.
I'm naked right now.
Yes, you are. You look great, by the
way. Yoga.
And you're a vegan and you moisturize.
My entire body.
One must.
I do.
Oh, so do I.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay, let's talk about
me.
How you, a young Scotsman, ends up at the Cafe Carlyle singing one of Sondheim's great female anthems. How did it begin?
God, I don't know. I mean, it's such a random... It's funny, yesterday I did a thing for Immigrant Heritage Month, which is in June, and I was being asked these questions about how I came to be here and everything. And it's nuts. I mean, I really didn't mean... This is a complete accident. I never thought my life would end up... I never thought I would ever come to... I was 30 before I ever came to America. I had a whole other life, and I think that's actually quite a healthy thing to have, this slight outsider's eye still, and also to have had another entirely different experience that was entirely without any of the mores of American culture.
But mores, you mean?
Mores or mores, whatever, s'mores.
The s'mores of American culture.
yeah. But I just came, I made a movie in 1994, and it's in Ireland, and it came to America, and they asked me to come to do the press tour. And
please tell me that you're talking about Circle of Friends.
I am.
I saw that when it came out.
You did?
I went to a movie theater and watched it.
It's a good film. I liked it.
A very good film. And you came screaming off the screen. I mean, was that your first film?
No, it wasn't my first film. I'd done a couple of films in Europe before then. But it's the first film that had been out in America.
Well, I know that people are very familiar with you from The Good Wife and from Cabaret and all these other iconic performances you've given in really big venues. But I always hasten to let people know that there was a movie in the early 90s called Circle of Friends, when I first saw you, that you were so vivid. The performance was indelible, really.
It was such a good part. He was such a big slime ball.
He really was.
Yeah.
And romance was hard to find.
I just don't feel that way about you, Sean.
I don't think you're in quite a situation to be so proud and choosy.
But I always assumed that's what you were really like. It's one of those performances that was so convincing that I was really afraid of you.
Oh, good. No, it's so weird because it's such a funny thing now when I think back, because it was, you know, it was a kind of an intense performance, and he was like the baddie of it. Was a great, great, great part. And Pat O'Connor, who directed it, was really letting me just rip with it. But when I think back to it, I mean, he's kind of this awful person. Yeah, I'm sort of fond of him, as, you know, I guess because that film was my entree into what is now my life, in some ways. But he was just this awful rapist and thief, and I'd get like horrible teeth painted on me. My teeth got all painted yellow every day, and he had slimy, slimy hair. And
he sort of reminded me of the Child Catcher from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Here we are, children. Come and get your lollipop.
Oleaginous is another word that's used great amounts about him.
What does that mean?
It means slimy, really. Yeah. Just a posh word for slimy, I think.
So you come to America to do press for this great little movie. And fill in, just give me, when do you first encounter Sondheim? Like, when do you first start thinking about singing and songs?
Oh, well, I'd sung, but when I came to do that, like, I'd done Cabaret in London. I just finished Cabaret in London when I made that movie. So I'd been, singing and like actor who sings, you know what I mean? And I'd done a cabaret. I used to do a stand-up comedy act in the 80s, early 90s with my friend Forbes Masson called Victor and Barry. And we sang songs and we released an album, and we were kind of quite big in Scotland and Britain. And we did like an Australian tour and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, hello.
We're Victor and Barry, and we're from Kelvin's Eye.
That's right.
Now, where is that? I hear you gasp.
Shall I look it up in the Showbiz Dictionary?
On you go then, Vic.
Kelly Marie, Kelly Monteith, Kevin Klein, Calvin Klein.
Kelvinside.
Oh, you bet.
Kelvinside is a district in Glasgow, which is a major city in Scotland, which is a country to the north of England and to the left of Mrs. Thatcher.
Yes.
Wait. I'm sorry. Time out. Forgive me. I want to get the timeline right. So you had already done the MC in Cabaret?
Yeah.
In London?
In 1993. End of 93 into 94, yeah.
Oh, you know, I did not know that.
You didn't? Well, look.
I thought, forgive me, I thought you were an unknown. I mean, certainly you were unknown here, yeah. But I didn't know that you had already established this big career by the time you did that film.
Oh, honey. Yeah. So, I was like, I just played Hamlet. I played Hamlet at the Dormer Warehouse, and just to great acclaim. And then I did the MC at the Dormer Warehouse with Sam Mendes, and then I made this film. So yeah, I was kind of like a little, you know, up and coming hotshot in Britain, in London.
So had you always been singing?
Always singing. I mean, sort of. Not like now I'm singing. Not like doing concerts and all that and having an album. Absolutely not. And the singing I did it with a stand-up comedy act, it was kind of silly singing. It was comedy singing uh-huh. in these characters.
Uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh. We're well-known faces in Calvin's side. The trendy thespians. Some of our best friends are less well known than us.
The big difference for me is cut to 2009 when I do a concert for the first time as myself.
Right.
And that is, I can't describe how massive a leap that is for a performer. It certainly was for me to go from performing songs as someone in character, a different accent, a different person you're inhabiting, and then suddenly just go, I'm Alan Cumming, I sound like this, I'm singing these songs, I'm telling you stories about my life. That was a huge, huge, terrifying thing to do. But
and exhilarating.
Now I love it. Yeah, yeah. And I've got really a lot better at it now.
Well, yeah, you just sold out Carnegie Hall.
That's right, yeah. Not doing so bad.
So you're still an up-and-coming hotshot, apparently.
But though, so Sondheim, I can't remember. I think I met him probably when he came to see Cabaret the first time round in 1998 or so.
Welcome, bienvenue, welcome. Fremda, étranger, stranger. Glücklich zu sehen.
And I remember having this enormous chat with him about jigsaws. He's obsessed with jigsaws. And we had this big chat about that. I sang a song of his. There was a gala for one of his, you know, he's had so many huge birthdays. I can't remember which was it, 75, 80, 85?
All of the above.
It's so funny because everyone, I remember singing at one of these galas. And I was like, isn't it amazing? And like Donna Murphy or someone went, oh, we'll all be here again in 5 years when he's 80, when he's 90 or whatever. Not.
Sure enough, and we will have just finished no, the last one for 85.
It
they
feels
go
like
on
it, doesn't
on.
It? Yeah. It just feels like I've been celebrating Stephen Sondheim since I came to New York. And why not? He's worth it. So I sang a song of his at a gala, and he was there, and that was absolutely terrifying. I sang Being Alive. And then, so when I was doing my first concert thing, anyway, I did a mashup of Losing My Mind with an Elvis Costello and Burt Bacharach song called I Still Got the Other Girl in My Head. Mm. And then I did a workshop of Company that John Tiffany, the amazing director who I worked with a few times, did for the Roundabout. It was kind of, you know, notorious because it was called the Gay Company because it was Bobby was going to be gay and some of the genders of some of the couples was going to be changed. Mm-hmm. So there'd be some same-sex couples. And I ended up playing the Elaine Stritch part. So that's why I sang.
Uh-huh.
That's why I knew, you know, I worked on this incredible song and grew to think. I mean, and also what was amazing and what I really think is amazing about doing my concert and everything is that, and what I tried to do, the whole point of me doing it really, is I want people to listen to songs in a different way because I'm singing them. And I think a lot of the songs I sing, people know and think of them a certain way. And then when I sing them, they're like, what?
Sure, sometimes Alan Cumming makes us go, what? But it's a lot of fun along the way. I'm Julian Fleischer. You're listening to The Naked American Songbook. And if you thought that made you say what, when we come back, we'll hear Alan compare Cabaret to Hamlet. It's not just the moisturizer. Alan Cumming is a great actor. In the pantheon with Ralph Fiennes and Laurence Olivier.
You don't believe me? Hmm? Well, don't take my word for it. Go ahead. Try Helga.
You talk about Cabaret, which is obviously an enormously important show in your life. You've done the role, what, three times by my count?
Yes, three.
I think you own the role. It's hard to really imagine at this point someone else.
I don't agree. I think actually, you know, I think what is interesting about... Because when I first, as I said, I'd just done Hamlet when I did it first. And so when you do a big classic role like that, you're always compared to other people. Everyone's saying, right. You know, and there's like a list of who's just done it. And like, I think, mm-hmm. you know, like Ralph Fiennes did it after me. And I can't remember who did it before me in London, you know.
I think it was Laurence Olivier.
not immediately prior. I know I'm old and... My moisturizer's working well, but not that old. Anyway, but then, and then, you know, but I think in a way that role in Cabaret is so, it's such a great role. I've only ever done two musicals on the stage, Cabaret and the Threepenny Opera. So I have a niche, mm-hmm. and I'm sticking to it.
I used my mind and I protected her. She used her body and supported me.
Right, which and is this German sound.
A German
music.
Weimar-y kind of... You know, dun, 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 dun.
Well, what is it about Kander and Ebb?
What I think is great about Kander and Ebb is they actually use forms of performance. Like there's cabaret and there's like a vaudeville, and right. they're just very cleverly use things from a certain period to infuse the whole story. And so you become immersed in the show in a way that you don't with other kind of modern musicals.
It's a performance about a performance.
Yeah. And also the sort of fabric of the show takes you right to that place, because it's kind of naturalistic in a way, because you're using the music of the time or evocative of the time. And I just think they're soulful and lovely. I don't know. I really, really love them. I'd love to do more of their things. I'm actually thinking of singing more, because I got this great album that John Kander released, this album of all the demos that he and Fred recorded over the years.
Yes.
Just, you should listen to anyone who's a fan of them, even if you're not. It's so beautiful to hear, because Fred sings a lot of the songs, mm-hmm. and I love listening to him sing. And there's one actually I really want to do. I've heard Liza singing it. It's called Yes. It's just about saying yes to life and all these things. And Fred sings it, and it's just enchanting.
Yes.
Well, let's listen to it now.
Oh, let's.
Say yes. Life keeps happening every day, say yes. When opportunity comes your way, you can't start wondering what to say. You'll never win if you never play. Say yes. There's mink and marigold right outside, long white Cadillacs you can ride, but nothing's gained if there's nothing tried. Say yes. Don't say why, say why not. What lies beyond what is not. So what? Say yes. Yes, I can. Yes, I will. Yes, I'll take a sip. Yes, I'll touch. Yes, of course. Yes, how nice. Yes, I'd happily thank you very much. Yes, oh yes. There's lots of chaff, but there's lots of wheat. Say yes. You might get mugged as you walk the street, but on the other hand, you might greet that handsome stranger you've longed to meet. Say yes. What lies beyond what is not.
Is not.
So what?
So what?
Say yes. Yes. Yes, I'll walk. Yes, I'll look. Yes, I'd love to do such and such. Yes, I'll try. Yes, I'll dare. Yes, I'll fly. Yes, I care. Yes, I'll happily thank you very much. Yes, oh yes, oh yes. You can't look back on a chance that's lost. Say yes.
Yes.
The dice mean nothing unless they're tossed. The throw is usually worth the cost. The hope of summer denies the frost. Say yes. Yes, I am.
Isn't that gorgeous? That's Fred Ebb and John Kander, the authors of that song, singing it somewhere live. Who knows where? But I just love that. So beautiful.
It's so charming.
And just like, oh, just say it. Just do it. I'm very much a yes person.
You can imagine that they had Liza in mind when they wrote that.
Oh, totally. Oh, they wrote millions of things for Liza. And actually, you know, when Liza does it, it's a mammoth big... It's actually lovely to hear it in a sort of simple way like that, because that's what I love about, you know, getting to know a song, going back to a song that you think of in a certain way, then you suddenly hear it in a different way and it opens itself up to you.
Yes, that's what the standard songbook is so good for, revisiting.
Yeah, yeah.
Reimagining, learning new things from them. I don't know if I've ever heard Liza do it. I must have heard her do it.
Yes, I can. Yes, yeah. I will. Thank you very much. Yeah. Da, 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 da.
Oh, you're good at that.
It's on Liza with a Z.
Oh, so I have.
Yeah,
heard.
Yeah.
Yes, oh yes.
I love Liza Minnelli to the moon and back. I think she's just the most lovely, lovely person. I mean, I.
Yes.
I don't know, it's another crazy thing that I would end up performing with her. I have a sign in my house upstate. I have a big sign that was above the stage in the town hall when we played the town hall in New York City. It's light bulbs that spell out Liza and Alan. And I, as soon as I saw it, I just thought, I've got to have that. And I bludgeoned it into my possession. And it's now in my house in the Catskills. And the thing is, when you plug it in, it's so intense. It's like being in a sunbed. There's so many bulbs. It's so hot. I just plug it in like once a night just to look at it and then immediately take it off again.
Right before bed?
Yeah, yeah, when I'm a little pale. But it's, I just, you know, I met her because of Cabaret, and we just became friends. And shortly after I met her, I did the Kennedy Center Honours when Kander and Ebb were being honoured. And right. So I worked with Liza, and she had the job of trying to teach me how to do that shoulder dance thing for New York, New York, which, you know, to like move like her.
Yeah.
It didn't go well. And she was like trying to, you just put your shoulder down, honey. And then eventually she just went, oh, just do it your own way. Because I couldn't get it. And then we made that thing, and we made a record. We recorded a song together, and for this album of Christmas songs.
I really can't stay.
Liza, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
Liza, it's cold outside.
Over the years, we just, you know, stayed friends, and then we did this. It was my friend Daniel Nardiccio, you know him too, he's a producer and nightlife promoter, was doing these things out in Fire Island, these concert things, and he asked me to do one, and I was like, sure. And then he said, would you mind having someone as a guest? And I was like, sure, because frankly, I have to perform less and sooner in the bar. And then he said, it's Liza. And I was like, holy crap. So Liza came to
Fire Island
and to Cherry Grove as well, not to the Pines, you know. And it was sort of like a papal visit. It really was. I mean, she was in this boat, you know, arriving on the ferry, and there's all these other little boats following. And when I talk about it in my show, it's like a papal visit, if you can imagine the Catholic Church being full of homosexuals. So we did these two concerts together, and it was just so magical. And it was the hottest night of the summer, and it was just, there was no air conditioning or anything. And in between shows, we sat in the beer fridge, you know, the walk-in beer fridge. We're sitting on crates of beer. Liza smoking inside a fridge.
Oh, God.
And then we did them in New York. We took it to New York. I think it's the only show that's ever transferred to Broadway from
Fire Island.
But, you know, I just love her so much. And she's really helped me, actually, in terms of doing concerts like this. When I was first going to do the Lincoln Center American Songbook thing, and I happened to be in Scotland rehearsing a play, and she was happened to be in Scotland doing a concert. And we had dinner the night before our concert, and we have a great sort of, you know, chemistry together. But also she's been incredibly sort of generous with her knowledge, and I've learned such a lot from her. She told me this thing about how when you sing a song as yourself, think of it like you're in a play. The song is a play and you're a character moving through the song, and there's different acts and there's different parts of the story. And
oh, I love that.
And it's so simple, but it's absolutely brilliant.
It's also very sophisticated.
I'm trying to.
She seems so childlike in one respect, and yet she's clearly so sophisticated in another.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's very womanly in one way, but very sort of genderless, powerful and commanding, but also fragile and tiny. And
yeah,
she's just like Peter Pan or something.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing about her is that you worry for her. Worry for her when she's performing. By worrying, you invest so much in her. And then, of course, she feels that energy from an audience, and that fuels her. And then she just blossoms and glows in front of you.
And it's all real. It's
completely real.
I just don't ever think it's put on.
I'll never forget you.
I mean, I love that she She's a complete, most incredible showman. Mm-hmm. You know, that's another thing she taught me about how to retain your authenticity, but to be a showman as well. Because you can't, you're putting on a show and you've got to do it again and again. But at the same time, you know, there's a reason why we look at some people more than others on a screen or on a stage or whatever. And it's because those people are being vulnerable and being authentic and being committed to you. It sounds easy, and it is, but it's like jumping off a cliff into a little pool of crocodiles with their mouths open.
Thank you so much. That's a beautiful image.
Maybe this time, for the first time, love won't hurry away.
What fascinates me about your choices, your list of songs, is what connects them somehow, like through your imagination. Like, how do we go from Liza to Aretha? Or is it a short leap or a big one?
Well, it's really this song, the Respect song. These are songs that really just get me in some way.
Yeah.
And this one gets me on a kind of horned up, sexy sort of way.
Ooh.
And I just feel, it's like when I DJ, because I DJ sometimes, whenever I put this on, it's just, you know, the party's just taking a different gear change and it's sexing it all up a bit. And I first really got to love the song years and years and years and years ago in London in like 1988. I did a play which was in Scotland at the Traverse Theatre, and it transferred to the Royal Court in London. It was a big thing for me. It's my first, my West End debut and blah, blah, blah. And I had to be really sexy in it. And I was like 23 years old. I mean, I was sexy, but, you know, I wasn't confident. I knew I had to walk on the stage and I had to imagine that everybody in the theatre wanted to fuck me. And it's... Oh, sorry, I keep saying fuck.
No, I like that. I'm just trying to think if I've ever had that feeling.
Well, I mean, I think some parts you do have to feel that, you know. And it got a couple of, quite a few parts I've played now have to, I feel that's an important part of the...
Well, certainly for...
For the MC, definitely.
Well, you're so...
But this was like this German sort of punky boy, and it's this weird German play by Manfred Karg. It's called The Conquest of the South Pole. So I used to listen to Respect right before I pushed open these doors and walked onto the stage, and it made me feel really sexy.
I love that story. Here it is.
Yeah.
You're about to feel sexy.
Who's hers?
I
know, fantastic, fantastic. And I love the kind of backing singers as well. I love that kind of...
Well, you know, Otis Redding recorded that album.
I love that one as well.
It's good, but somehow...
Aretha makes it, she's the one. The thing I think is really fascinating about those recordings is they didn't multi-track them. They did them just live in one recording. And actually, this next song is an interesting story about that. The Frank Sinatra, That's Life. They recorded that iconic, amazing performance of That's Life with the Hammond organ thing, which I love that sound. They recorded that in... He was in the room with the band when he sang it. And the reason I know that is because I did this movie called Burlesque with Cher and Christina Aguilera.
Oh, my God. And that's right. I love that movie.
You do?
Good. I actually do.
Okay, don't point at me like that. I believe you.
You looked at me.
I know. I was just going, oh, dude.
Oh, no, I love
that's
it.
That's nice. Great. And
great enthusiasm, terrible timing.
The thing was, one of the reasons why I have not such fond memories of it as you do, is that I had a big number that was cut, which was That's Life. And what they did was, and it was, I knew I was cut because it was really stupid because I was, you know, the doorman of the club, and it was the only song that would be not a performance song in the, because all the other ones, the girls were performing it in the club. And it's on the DVD. I really like it, but it's me with the boys, you know, we're setting up, and just all of a sudden I start singing. Crazy idea. Anyway, what they did was they got That's Life, the 1965 version that Frank did, and they took Frank's vocals off it at great expense because they had to like rub him out,
yeah,
as it were.
So those were the actual tracks.
That was the actual Frank track, and I had to sing on top of Frank. I had to sing, like I actually had to do certain things I perhaps wouldn't have done vocally
because
he did it a certain way. And also the pace of it was the way he slowed down and sped it up. And I really loved singing it, but it's just a fascinating thing. Like in that time, they just recorded things and made things in a completely different way to how the sort of regimented way we do it all individually in little scrappy bits, and we sometimes never meet the people who are on the track with us nowadays. And I actually like it much better the old way, and I love this song, even though it has, you know, it could have ruined the song for me forever, the fact it was cut from the movie. It doesn't.
Well, and if it's on the DVD, we're all good. I can't wait to go back and see it. But I also understand that he was forced to re-record it. Do you know this little story?
No.
The producer was not in love with the first take, and he was forced to re-record it by the producer, and he was pissed off. That rarely happens. So the recording that we all know so well, that I believe we are about to listen to, is a very angry.
An angry Frank.
Frank.
Gosh, let's hear it.
Frank.
That's life.
That's life.
That's what all the people say. You're riding high in April, shot down in May. But I know I'm gonna change that tune. When I'm back on top in June, I said that's life.
That's life.
And as funny as it may seem, some people get their kicks stomping on a dream. But I don't let it get me down. 'Cause this fine old world, it keeps spinning around. I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out, and I know one thing. Each time I find myself flat on my face, I pick myself up and get back in the race. That's life.
That's life.
I tell you, I can't deny it. I thought of quitting, baby, but my heart just ain't gonna buy it. And if I didn't think it was worth one single try, I'd jump right on a big bird and then I'd fly. I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out, and I know one thing. Each time I find myself laying flat on my face, I just pick myself up and get back in the race. That's life.
That was Frank Sinatra singing That's Life in 1965.
And that is Alan Cumming, my guest today on the Naked American Songbook. You got to do that song in a movie.
I did. And you know the most hilarious thing was, because it was all these dancers, these boys who played like the waiters and the barman, and they were the dancers in the show. And they're all these incredible dancers. Like they danced for, you know, Madonna and all these Cirque du Soleil and all these things. And the hilarious thing in this number that was cut was that I danced, and they kind of just like flicked towels at me and things and threw lemons at me once in a while. It was so ridiculous. These like the world's top dancers watching me dance.
That's cute.
Indignity.
Oh, come on. You must have liked it a little
bit. I loved it. It was great. But I mean, just when you stand back from it, you think, what is wrong with this picture? You know.
Well, let me encourage our listeners to run to their laptops and dial this up on YouTube, because I know I would if I had a laptop in front of me right now.
Yeah.
That sounds too good to be true.
Yeah, well, it was pretty good.
And
it was too good to be true because it was cut.
That's too bad.
Showbiz.
That is Showbiz, and this is the Naked American Songbook. In just a moment, Alan Cumming and I play a little game of this or that.
Gotta be this or that.
And now back to my chat with Alan Cumming. We are about to play a little game of this or that, and the rules are simple.
All right.
I'm going to say like salt or pepper.
Salt. Oh, no, pepper.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Why pepper?
I like pepper. I always would rather put pepper on things. Like, you know when you get oil and bread? I always put pepper in my oil and piss everyone off.
All right, here we go. Barbara or Judy?
Judy.
Why?
I just feel Judy is more of... I mean, Barbara, I feel, has an incredible voice. My old singing teacher at drama school said that he thought Barbara Streisand was the voice of the century. That was last century, but nonetheless. That's a lot coming from a classical... You know, he was a countertenor.
A lot of classical people feel that way.
Yeah, she is an incredible instrument. I mean, like, crazy, almost like alien. But I feel Judy Garland is an artist that I respond to more in that she's much more kind of vulnerable.
I'm bald.
Cabaret or Chicago?
Cabaret. But that's like Sophie's Choice, but I, you know, that would be terrible if I didn't say that.
Josh Charles or Chris Noth?
And for what?
That's, I don't know. Good question.
I'd have Josh Charles because I haven't seen him for a while.
Oh, that's nice.
There you go.
I've been watching you from afar.
Rufus or Liza?
Liza.
Naturally.
Yes. Love right. Rufus, of course, but he's coming to dinner at my house on Sunday night, actually.
Is he really?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to do a concert in Detroit and I'm flying back to cook for Rufus and Yorn.
It's a big effort. Does he know that?
I'm not sure if he does.
I'm sure he'll appreciate it.
Me and Liza, Liza and I, famous till the day that we die.
I want to ask you, my guest Alan Cumming, what's the first record you bought with your own money?
Oh, it was the single of I'll Be Your Long-Haired Lover from Liverpool by Little Jimmy Osmond. Do you remember him? Where is he now? You never heard of him?
I actually have never heard of Little Jimmy Osmond.
What?
I'm embarrassed to say. I mean, I have a pretty comprehensive knowledge of things.
Isn't that interesting? I wonder if that was just he was big in Britain. He was like the Osmond's little brother. And he
like
was
an actual Osmond?
Yeah, Jimmy Osmond. Little Jimmy Osmond.
He was like Donny Osmond's brother?
Yep, absolutely. And he did this thing. It was number one forever. And it was just, I just thought it was the most sophisticated, fabulous thing ever.
I think it's hard to imagine that a song called Long-Haired Lover from Liverpool would be a hit in the States.
Sung by a kind of chubby little prepubescent. Yeah. The chorus goes, I'll be your long-haired lover from Liverpool and I'll do anything you ask.
And so what drew you to the song and made you, you know, dig into your pants pocket and pull out a crown?
I guess it was such a jolly song. And it was just like a little boy. I mean, I was probably the same age as Little Jimmy Osmond, so I probably had slight, you know, envy of him getting to sing this, be a big performer. Not that I really knew I wanted to do that at the time, but maybe it was a bit of that. He was my age. He was singing this big song. I loved it.
All right, let's hear this. Christmas number one record in the UK in 1972. Osmond, the youngest Osmond, with Long-Haired Lover from Liverpool. Ugh, I have certainly never heard that song before and certainly never want to hear it again. What must your parents have thought when you came home with that?
I don't. Well, it was like massive. It was like at number one for like months.
Oh, okay.
It was like everywhere.
Really?
Little Jimmy Osmond was a sensation in Britain.
I can't believe
you didn't have him here. What did they do with him?
They shipped him off to London.
And I wonder why they must have surely pulled him out at concerts. I was 7 when that record came out.
And he was like 35.
Little Jimmy. Yeah. He's screaming sort of, away there.
He is. I mean, it's actually a sort of a not bad quality to his voice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it cuts.
For a castrati.
And what does it mean, a long-haired lover from Liverpool? Is that like a reference to the hippie movement? Or
I don't know. I mean, I didn't think. And then Sunshine Lady from LA. I didn't remember that part.
It sounds like a reference to Joni Mitchell.
Oh, it does? Gosh, it's full. And it might be the Beatles, maybe Long-Haired Lover from Liverpool, the Beatles. It's got so many musical references. It just was such a, it was just like a kind of summer fun lyric. And he was, I can't tell you, he was a legend. And then where is he now? I'd really love to know. I'm going to, as soon as I finish this interview, I'm going to go and Google Little Jimmy Osmond. I suppose he's Big Jimmy Osmond now.
And I'm going to post it to our Facebook page too.
Please do.
The history of Little Jimmy Osmond.
Maybe you could get him on the show.
No, that's okay. Thank you, though.
Explore his oeuvre.
One of the questions I asked you to think about in preparing for this interview was to share with me and my listeners here on the Naked American Songbook a guilty pleasure.
Yes, I haven't done that because I don't agree with guilty pleasure. I don't think any pleasure should have guilt prefixing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I...
Go on.
I think it's a... I mean, it's not just an American thing, but I think American people are too predisposed to associating anything they like too much with guilt and shame. And so... In a sort of hedonistic way, I suppose, I think pleasure should be pleasure and you shouldn't attach anything negative to it.
Did you grow up a Catholic?
No.
Did you grow up religious at all?
I mean, we went to church sometimes, but it wasn't like a massive part of my life. But I did. I was confirmed in the church when I was 16. I joined the church and then I forgot I joined. And then about 5 years later or 7 or 8 years later, I signed this thing. Saying I was an atheist, it was sort of, celebrity atheist. And it was like, it was only like 100 top atheists of Britain or something. And I forgot that I was actually a confirmed member of the Church of Scotland. So the Church of Scotland contacted my mum. She was mortified. And they said, well, if your son's an atheist, perhaps he'd like to... So I got kind of disbarred from the church. They actually had to sign a form saying I wasn't a member anymore. They really...
Their loss.
I thought so. But I just thought, well, God, there's millions of people in the same boat as me. They just... I joined the church like it was just, going to get a new pair of shoes at the end of, before I went to school.
Well, it's like a bar mitzvah for me. Like I'm.
They're sort of tradition things rather than religious things.
I mean, I'm not sorry I was bar mitzvahed. I certainly am. Just any other kind of form of study, I learned a lot of stuff. And
right.
It just doesn't,
And it's the ritual. It's the ritual kind of thing of bar mitzvahs as well, isn't it?
It's what it does for your
celebrations.
Parents,
is it? Why?
Well, I just found that like my bar mitzvah was really more for my mother than it was for me.
Oh, in what way?
God, how do I even describe it? In every conceivable way. It's like...
Because she was able to show that she'd thrown a big party and...
We actually had a very small... We had like a lunch.
Was she more religious then, you mean?
The tradition of watching your son go to the Bima and read from the Torah and chant beautifully.
Right.
It's a moment of just very deep pride for a parent, whereas I think most kids could take it or leave it.
Right. Another thing in the Good Wife, I play a Jewish person. I'm not Jewish, but I play one on TV. And we shot a scene, signing of the thing that you sign before you get married.
Ketubah, yes.
The ketubah, yeah. I'd never heard of it. It sounds like either a kind of a musical instrument or...
Oh, it sounds to me like something you like have removed surgically.
Ketubah.
Well, one reason I know that you're not Jewish is because as a person who was raised Jewish, guilt and pleasure are very difficult to separate. And I admire people who apparently have succeeded in doing that.
Mm. I mean, I think if you take pleasure in something that hurts people, then obviously that's different. We're talking about just stuff that you actually really, really like. But I think that the thing that I've really noticed more recently, actually, in America, is that people here are very, everyone's so worried about being judged and valued and everything. In terms of music, when they hear a piece of music, and I've noticed this when I was in my club that I had in my dressing room after cabaret, my club coming, I would put on a song and people would be like, what is this? And they'd really want to know what it was before they would let themselves enjoy it.
Mm.
Why don't you listen to it first and see if you like it and I'll tell you at the end. Oh. And some of them could not handle that. And this next song is a perfect example of that because I think this is a classic. It's a musical theatre song, souped up. Why don't we just hear it?
And then we'll
tell you who it is afterwards.
This is Alan Cumming's Guiltless Pleasure.
Yeah.
What would I give if I could live out of these waters? What would I pay to spend a day warm on the sand? That you're on land, they understand that they don't. Of swimming, ready to stand. And I'm ready to know what the people know. Ask them my questions and get some answers. What's a
I'm going to hand it to you, Alan Cumming. I'm going to give you that one.
Isn't it great?
It actually is. I mean, I didn't love it when I listened to it on my own, but sitting here across the table from you, watching you live...
Well, you have to open your heart to it, to the campiness of it. And the It's Jessica Simpson, one of the most underrated American songstresses I think there are.
It goes Ella, Sarah, Billy, Jessica.
Yeah, but she mastered... I think it's... You know, but that's really an interesting point. Like, if I was to say to people when they ask me, who is that? And then if I said at the end of it, when we'd all like let go and we've gone with the campiness and gone with the fun of it, and it's a great song, and they do this really poppy modulations up the wazoo arrangement. Right. They go, who was that? And I go, Jessica Simpson. And they're kind of like, oh, and I liked it. And I say, see, rethink your prejudices, people.
Ooh, that's a shaming finger you just pointed
at me. It was, it is.
So that doesn't help, actually.
No, but I think that's, I want them to go into the...
piece of advice.
Well, the finger of shame. No, but I think people should not...
If you're trying to remove guilt and shame from the equation, a shaming finger is not the way to do it.
Well, no, the shame I was referring to was the fact that I was trying to tell them not to do the thing that was shameful. Because they were putting shame onto Jessica.
You were trying to shame the shame.
I was shaming the shamer.
It's a shame shamer.
But isn't it great?
I think it is great, and I'm curious how you came across it.
Well, here's the thing. I'm not so crazy about the girl who sings it. It's a beautiful sort of, you know, version, but it's all kind of too sweetie, sticky sweetie.
You mean the original?
There's one. I love finding like disco remixes of classical sort of, you know, cutesy. But there's a hilarious, you know, that Ethel Merman released a disco album in the 70s. It's
classic.
Have that. Oh, you do? It's just fantastic. I like that sort of mixture of, you know, taking stuff and putting a beat to it. Because I don't see why you can't do anything with a beat. Make anything into a dance.
Of course. That's what we're here to do, is
dance,
essentially.
Live.
I want to
say yes.
Share with you my version of what you just played for me. A sort of a Disney-esque anthem from an animated film that some people, when they listen to it, give you the same, like, what is this? And I'm like, you know... just go with it. It's going to blow your mind.
Okay.
Stephen Schwartz, the composer.
I love him.
And he wrote this song for The Prince of Egypt. It's sung by Mariah Carey
and
Whitney Houston.
Shut up.
And the one duet that they did together, it won the Oscar.
Wow.
Have you never heard this?
I don't believe I have.
Buckle up, sister.
Oh, God, I'm prepared. Guarding my loins. I'm spent. I am absolutely exhausted after that.
Thank you.
Oh, I can't believe I've never heard that before.
I can't believe I've never heard that either. And I frankly feel like I just popped some cherry.
You did.
And
my Mariah Whitney cherry.
It's the only song they ever recorded together. And there was a lot of ginned up excitement about what would happen when these two met. And of course, they got along famously. They adored each other.
Right. You know what it reminds me of? That Lakme thing, Dalib. You know? The kind of fluttery birdiness of it.
Oh, yes.
You know what I mean? That one,
yes.
How does it go again?
Yes.
Yeah, that fluttery birdie thing. How amazing is that? Prince of Egypt, Prince of Egypt.
It's orgasmic. So, yeah. Come back one day, will you?
I'd love to, yeah. I really enjoyed it. It's nice to have a big chat about things that you don't normally, you only have going on in your head.
Thank you.
Thank you, Julian. This was such fun.
I hope you had a good time.
I did.
Know I did. And, you know, you live inside of songs. And it's very exciting to talk to someone who does that.
Oh, thanks. That's very nice.
I will see you in the Catskills.
Yes, au revoir.
Okay. The Naked American Songbook is a production of the Jonathan Channel, WNYC and WQXR in New York City. Please look us up on the network's social. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc. Find our podcast wherever you park your podcast. Tell a friend about us and call the listener line at 347-229-1343. Tell us what you're listening to and what you're wearing when you're listening to it. Aaron Dalton is Horatio. Hilary Bonhomme is Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Ellie Smirling is Ophelia. Mike Shobe is definitely Hamlet. And I am Spear Carrier number 2. Our theme music was written by me. I'm Julian Fleischer. Thanks for listening. Keepest thou naked.
Boom. That was nice. God, that's such a great find. How amazing is that? Prince of Egypt, Prince of Egypt. I must remember that.
Yes, the Prince of Egypt. It's got some crazy lyrics in it, too. It's like, when you're blinded by your pain, can't see your way clear through the rain, a small but still resilient voice says hope is very near. They fit all that into the bridge.
Wow. Gosh, I've got in my head is John Edwards. You know, remember him? He was going to be the vice president and then he had a baby with someone.
Yes.
Because when I was at the Democratic Convention the year that John Kerry was going to be the president and he was going to be the vice president, his big speech, John Edwards, was if you're an old lady on disability and you're wondering if you're going to blah, blah, hope is on the way. And he kept it, the chorus of his speech, the kind of refrain was, hope is on the way. And he did this weird thing with his tongue licking his lips.
Ooh.
Now that you said that lyric, I will forever think of John Edwards.
Oh God, I'm so sorry. I didn't want to do that to you.
So let's talk about more filth.